looking at the different, the four main frameworks that are used to interpret Revelation, as I came upon historicism, we dealt with how historicism really began at the, around 1200, 1300, as the Roman Catholic Church went through a tremendous amount of turmoil, upheaval. You had multiple popes, multiple times. Everything seemed to be in disarray. They declared the Crusades. The popes really became much, much more politically powerful, becoming not just the vicar of Christ, but a king on earth with his own lands and palaces, etc. And historicism was really birthed out of that. And the Pope was seen as being the Antichrist, and the Catholic Church being seen as Babylon, the harlot. I mentioned Revelation, and historicism kind of put an overlay over all these different events in history, and said Revelation is referring to these various specific things. And we saw how that then moved forward and was a very accepted view for much of the Reformation era, especially with their moving out of the Catholic Church. It seemed to very fit with their times, right? The Pope is the Antichrist. And we saw how even Jonathan Edwards and the Puritans identified with that. Now, because we did all of that history and then moved into where some of the more modern ideas came from with dispensationalism, etc., that caused me then to do some more backwards looking, and that's why we've been talking about some of the early church history. So last week we talked about first through third century Christian church views on Revelation and the end times. And you might remember that we saw that the book of Revelation was identified as a canonical book very early on, that it was referenced by many of the early church fathers in the second century, which is the first century really following the era of Christ and the early church, right? So first century is when Christ lived. Second century is when the first church without the apostles existed, the year 100 on. And so what we're really talking about is not first century, but second and third century, right? Just so we get our dates kind of straight in our heads. And what did we see in the first, second, and third century church when it came to eschatology, end times? We saw a tremendous amount of Jewish influence, that there was a widespread acceptance that there was going to be a 1,000-year physical, literal, political kingdom led by Christ, that it was going to be Christ's rule from the throne of David in Jerusalem, that there would be some sort of return, there'd be a resurrection of the dead, and this is what they were looking for. This is what they expected. We don't have a lot of writings to show us how they specifically interpreted all the things from Revelation, okay? But we understand that overarchingly, they had a belief that there was a literal 1,000-year kingdom coming, that there was a rescue from heaven coming for the persecuted church. Okay? The church was in a historic position of being persecuted and dealing with a great deal of hardship. Okay? They were a tremendously tiny minority sect out of a already minority sect, the Jewish sect. So they were seen as an offshoot of Judaism that was worthy of persecution and unworthy of any sort of consideration in society. Most of the membership of the church were poor, downtrodden, the slaves, and the lower classes. And while there may have been a few of upper class in there, they generally had to hide that. They weren't socially acceptable. And so we saw a lot of that. We talked about some various groups, the Ebionites, the Algoi. We talked about Papias, who was from 95 to 120. We talked about Justin Martyr, Melito, the Bishop of Sardis. We talked about the Miritonian Canon, which is the first published list of New Testament books, and Revelation was included in that. We talked about Theophilus of Antioch and Tertullian, who came around the year 180 AD. And Tertullian really is the first one that we have who has we have extant writings from that developed an eschatological framework for understanding what was going to happen. and wrote it down, and we have that. And we see in there a lot of connection to Revelation with the book of Daniel and the prophecies in Daniel, particularly the idea of the stone that came down and smashed the statue that Daniel saw in his vision, the gold head, the silver chest, the bronze waist and legs, the clay feet. And the stone comes, smashes that, and grows up to be a kingdom that takes over the world. Okay, and he identified that with Christ and with Christ's return and the coming thousand-year reign of Christ. He also connected the Antichrist, written about in John's epistles, to the beast in Revelation and to the man of sin referred to in Paul's epistles. And he connected those three. He saw Rome, the Empire of Rome being Babylon, referred to in Revelation, and that there was a completion of Daniel's 70 weeks that would come with the eventual return of Christ and setting up the thousand-year kingdom. And so we see a lot of the views of that are still held amongst premillennialists and pre-tribulationists being laid out even with Tertullian, even prior to the ideas of dispensationalism that have come in the modern era. I also mentioned to you last week that Tertullian, later in his life, got very involved with Montanism, which was a sect of Christianity led by a person named Montanus. And some of you asked me, well, what did they believe? Because eventually the church declared it to be heretical. So I did do some brief checking, and it was interesting because at one time there was a lot of disputing with the early church at this point, and we're talking around AD 180 to 200 about the Montanists, and they, remember, the canon had not been finalized at this point. There hadn't been kind of the final, these are the 27 books. And so what do we know about the early church when it came to their study of scripture and their preaching? They had preachers, and it talks about who prophesied, right? They would be led by the Holy Spirit to give a word from the Lord to their churches. And so the Montanists continued to believe that there was a lot of revelation yet to come, and that the Holy Spirit would fill their leaders with things to tell the church that were extra beyond what was in some of the apostolic letters that they had, which were already now 100 years old. And so they had a lot of very orthodox beliefs, but they also were starting to kind of go down some dangerous pathways and what they called at the time new prophecy. So it was newer revelation than what we accept today and what the church at that time was accepting as. Things had really firmed up. Despite the fact they hadn't finalized the canon, they still had the letters from the apostles that they viewed as kind of being the end, that all things should be interpreted and filtered through those letters. Okay, the Montanists came along and said, no, if we're getting newer revelation from God, those should trump older revelations. And so they did start to go down some dangerous paths. It has a lot of parallels with the charismatic movement of our modern time. They did a lot of what they referred to as ecstatic worship. Okay, and it's very similar, as I was studying this, it's very similar to a lot of the charismatic movement of the modern time. They also accepted women clergy. They believed that Jerusalem, now having fallen, was being relocated, that the new Jerusalem would be up in Asia Minor. There was a particular mountain in Turkey that they saw as being the new site for the new Jerusalem. And there was an interesting thing about lapsi. So it's a term you've probably not heard before. The lapsi. The lapsi were people who had chosen to in the midst of persecution, had chosen to bow down to Caesar or take an oath to Caesar or even to sacrifice to a false idol in order to escape martyrdom. So this is where the term lapse comes from, okay? And so the lapsi were people who had lapsed in their faithfulness to Christ in order to save their own necks. And there was a big dispute in the early church. Should these people, can these people be welcomed back into the fellowship or not? Can they still be saved? Or is it, hey, they're apostate once, therefore there's no salvation left for them? And you can think of some of the various letters and writings of Paul and in the book of Hebrews that would bring this question to the forefront. And so the Montanists held that these people could never be brought back into the church. Once they had fallen, they were out forever. Another interesting thing is once you would sacrifice to the idol, or you could even bribe the official to say that you had sacrificed to the idol, they would give you a piece of paper called a libelous. So now you get some of the idea of where the term libel comes from, right? And so it was a piece of paper that said you had done this. Anyway, just some very interesting tangential history to understand about things that were going on in the early church and some of the tensions that were happening. So we could talk a lot more about Montanism, but that's taking us away from talking about Revelation. But some of you asked, so I thought I'd give you a little crash course on it. So anyway, 3rd century, we're talking Irenaeus, Tertullian. We're seeing all of these early church beliefs then in a literal millennial kingdom, in a return of Christ, in the resurrection. And one final point I want to drive home before we move into the 4th century is this particular issue here. Okay, the fall of Jerusalem. What year did that happen?
70.
Okay, and so we're seeing here the 2nd century and the 3rd century Christians holding on to these beliefs, and none of their writings, okay, none of their beliefs harken back to the fall of Jerusalem as being the prediction of the book of Revelation. Okay? They do not tie that together. Now they tie the Olivet Discourse, which Jesus gives and talks about the temple, not one stone will remain on top of another, etc. They saw that being fulfilled in AD 70, but they don't tie Revelation to that fall, which is very different to compared to what that we already talked about. Anybody remember? What's the framework that does make that application very directly? I hear somebody whisper it.
Preterism,
that's right. Okay. So, that's the end of your review for the first few centuries. We're going to move into the 4th century. Remember that using the centuries as guidelines is imperfect. So this next person that we're going to reference as being kind of 4th century is really 3rd century. So don't shoot me, okay? That's not precise here. You know, these all things are, there's a progression to how these things come about, right? But the first one we want to talk about is Clement of Alexandria. He was doing this around 230 AD. Okay, now, Clement of Alexandria, interestingly enough, as you study him, he's not looked at as being one of the best scholars of all time of the early church, but he was an important figure nonetheless. And from the best records that we have available, he comes in and is the first one who connects the Olivet Discourse, the 70 weeks of Daniel, and the book of Revelation into one. Okay, so it's the first one. Of all the previous church fathers that we talked about, he is the first one to make that tie-in together. And so he believed that these were parallel accounts. that Revelation, the Olivet Discourse, and Daniel are parallel accounts. And they are all telling the same story, all parallel accounts of one particular event. And that's the fall of the temple, or of Jerusalem, in AD 70. So this is really the first writing we have now, out to 230 AD, where somebody is making this as a scholarly, church-specific teaching, that the fall of the temple is what the book of Revelation and Daniel were referencing specifically. Clement went on to offer very extensive discourses and books written about how this fulfillment was made. He talked about how the church is the new Israel, and that the church has now been exodused, okay? That the church exodus occurred from the old Egypt, which was Jerusalem. And he makes the parallels that Jerusalem was like Egypt of old. Okay, and there's biblical Old Testament scriptures to validate this particular point of view. There's prophecies and such that tell the people of Jerusalem that they are like Egypt of old. Okay, so there are biblical proof texts that you can use to justify these positions. So don't think he's totally crazy. Don't think that he's got no Bible to reference or to draw these conclusions. But he said that the church is the new Israel, and that they have been rescued from the old Egypt, which was Jerusalem, and that Jerusalem has suffered the same fate that Egypt of old faced, and that they were on their way to a new kingdom, that the Jewish era was over and ended. Now, it's really interesting to me that you're going to see, as we talk about Clement and as we talked about Tertullian and others, that these guys will have really powerful teachings and good Bible at times and good exegesis, but then they also just get, like, strange. And it really reminds me of modern-day people, too. Okay? Whether we're talking about Schofield or about Darby or talk about Jonathan Edwards, and you have these great biblical thinkers and ideas, right? Luther, we talked about how Luther and despite all his wonderful vision about justification by faith, when he got to Revelation, got really weird. And like, well, the Pope's the Antichrist. And so we see this happen too with Clement, because what I've told you about him so far, okay, we can figure this out. But then he goes on to say, and he uses Daniel's 70 weeks prophecy to do this, that he believes that after the first 7 weeks, and when you read the book of Daniel, you read the prophecy, it says the new temple will be set up in the first 7 weeks. Okay? He believes at the conclusion of this first 7 weeks that Jesus Christ began reigning in Jerusalem invisibly and then continued to reign invisibly until he was born. And that's just like, well, where are you getting all of this? Right? It's just like, whoa, what? Invisible reigning kingdom? What's going on? Okay? So it just starts to get a little weird.
That grape juice fermented a little bit too long.
I don't know. So anyway, the other very notable thing about Clement at this point is that he is the first one to say that John wrote Revelation in 65 A.D., under the Nero persecution. Up to this point, all of our writings, primarily sourced from Irenaeus, claim that John wrote the book of Revelation on the island of Patmos in 95 AD, and that it was under the Diocletian persecution. So that's Clement of Alexandria. Now, during this time period, you've got now sort of the mixing of different beliefs about end times going on. Because it's not like the beliefs we talked about last week in the first couple of centuries just disappeared. They're still very existent. They're still very persistent. The people like Clement of Alexandria and others, Eusebius in particular, who we're going to talk about in a minute, tended to call the ones who believed in a thousand-year kingdom coming, a millennium, who were premillennialists, if you are, they began to take on the name Chiliasts, which comes from the same root as this Greek word, kilo, okay, for thousand. So we don't, most of what we know about the Chiliasts in this period comes from those who are writing against them. Okay, as the church moved into more of what Clement of Alexandria believed, we get those writings. Those are the writings that exist, and they're detractors writing against the Chiliasts. Now, before we talk about a couple of the others, I want to talk about why I believe that this change of perception and the way of teaching Revelation was happening. Okay, so first and second century, third century Christians, what do we say? Very persecuted, very much a minority, and very heavily influenced by what? Judaism. Okay? And so that Jewish notion that there is a coming kingdom, right? Even we see the apostles ask that before Jesus' ascension. Is now the time that you're going to set up the kingdom? Right? And so that notion was very much a part of that. Jews were very much a part of what was going on in the church. So let's talk again about our history, world history. 70 AD, the temple falls. What happens to Judaism at the fall of the temple?
No longer had sacrifices.
No longer had animal sacrifices, no longer had a center hub of worship, no longer had what else? The priesthood, okay? All that's gone. What took over Judaism at that point? How was Judaism saved? Judaism became rabbinical. I'm not going to spell this right, I don't think.
Hey, yo.
It is. I'm not sure how it's spelled. Is that right? I'm not sure. Too many options. Okay, Judaism became very rabbinical and focused around the synagogues. Now, synagogues are a tradition in Judaism that dates back to the first captivity in Babylon. They started creating synagogues as kind of a alternate branch of the temple, right? And so the Jews after the fall who survived were like, okay, how are we going to survive as a nation and as a belief system? Well, they looked back to their earlier captivity. The temple had been destroyed the first time. They created synagogues, and they followed rabbinical leaders, kind of the extension of the Levite idea from the Old Testament. Okay, and so they got very focused on this. Now, as you can imagine, what was one of Judaism's biggest problems?
They had a division over the resurrected Christ and...
A little less specifically, they had a division over Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So, who is Jesus? Okay? Now, Jews up to this point, right, we read in our New Testament, Paul, Peter, John, they still went to the temple. They still went to the synagogues, right? They were believers in Christ as the Messiah, and they still participated in Jewish life. Okay, now the temple's fallen. The rabbis are taking over the maintenance of Judaism in a bigger way because there's no priesthood to follow. There's no Sanhedrin anymore. And they're continuing to face this, that Christian Jews are still coming to synagogue. What are we going to do with them? They're changing people's minds. They're convincing people to follow Jesus Christ. They're reading their Bibles and saying, see, Isaiah 53 is talking about Jesus Christ. And the rabbinical leaders did not want that. Okay? They didn't believe in Jesus being the Christ. So they started creating teachings and prayers that Christians in synagogue wouldn't say because it would be against Jesus Christ. They called Jesus a heretic, and they believed those who followed him were heretical. They started moving away from the Septuagint. Which is the Greek Old Testament, written in 200 BC, 200-ish BC, okay? And they started moving instead to what we call the Masoretic text, which was not ironclad, and they were able to still force certain books out and read certain interpretations. Interesting tangential note here, okay? If you go to your book of Genesis and read the lines and lifetimes of individuals who lived after the flood, and you read about how long Noah's sons lived, you will get to, I think, six particular generations where the Septuagint and the Masoretic text do not agree on how old somebody was when they had their next child. Okay? Most of our Bibles use the Septuagint for most things in the Old Testament, but they use the Masoretic text when they're talking about these lifetimes of these six generations in the line of Shem. And if you use the Masoretic text, all of a sudden you've got like these six generations that are a lot shorter. You've got these long lives that are getting shorter, and all of a sudden there's a big jump to shortness, and then they get long again. And it's like, why is that? And the Masoretic text does that, not the Septuagint. And some claim, some scholars claim, that they did this, the Jews did this on purpose, because by doing so they allow to make Shem into Melchizedek. Because then Shem is still alive when Abraham is born. And then the Jews could use that as an argument against the early Christians that Melchizedek was a priest with no connection to Abraham. So, really interesting stuff, right? So the early Jews, now at the fall of the temple, are trying to force Christianity out by using the text against them. And so we see now the Christian church faced with this opposition from Judaism. And as the church grew, there were more and more non-Jewish people in the church. And so the Jewish framework, the Jewish reference points, the Jewish way of thinking about the New Testament, about Jesus, about the future, began to fall out of favor in the church. Not just because there were fewer Jews there, but because the Jews that the people were familiar with were so hostile to Christianity. And so we start to see the rise of anti-Semitism within the church. Okay? I'm not blaming the Jews here for the rise of anti-Semitism any more than I'm trying to excuse the church for being anti-Semitic. Okay, it's not excusable. But I want you to understand that a lot of the early church now, by the 4th century, is starting to really be very oppositional to Jewish people. And that anti-Semitism really grew and grew and flourished over the next 1,500 years in the church. Martin Luther, very anti-Jewish. Other church leaders, very anti-Jewish. The Crusades, highly anti-Jewish, okay? And it started with some of this history that's going on here as the rabbis and the rabbinical liturgies were anti-Christian. And so you started to have this tension. And so Clement of Alexandria and some of these other ones we're going to quickly go through here, they wrote a lot of what they believed about the end times now in this perspective that was non-Jewish, that we shouldn't be looking at as Jewish, that the church had replaced the Jews, that they had escaped Jerusalem, that the Jewish era was over. And as I have studied the preterists and the idealists, they'll very distinctly tell you that the Jewish era ended at AD 70. That's it. The church is now the new Jewish kingdom. So, with that in mind, with that thinking about where the church is at, one other particular thing in history that's important at this point is the church was no longer the minority of a minority. Okay, the church was coming out of that. They were getting more and more purchased in everyday society. And we see by the early 300s, who rises to power in Rome?
Constantine.
Constantine, right? And so 3:11, there's the new dictate. Christianity is now the law of the land. And so suddenly there's no longer this drive to understand prophecy and the future in a, we need Christ to rescue us. Okay? Instead, the church is victorious. The church is marching ahead. The church is winning. We're taking over this place. We're ruling the kingdom. And so it's a much different way. It's a different framework now that the thinkers and the believers at the time look at as they view eschatology. And so we look now to Eusebius, who is known as the father of church history. Eusebius is from 260 to 340. Okay, he, in his writings of church history, very critical of the Chiliasts. That's where we get most of our understanding of them, is from Eusebius. He was very critical of Papias, who we saw last week was one of the really the first early church writers about a thousand-year millennium kingdom. He was critical of all millennialists. He believed, interestingly enough, though, despite that, and I took a picture here of his quote so I could read it to you because I just thought it was that interesting. He wrote about the book of Revelation. Yet, having formed an idea of it as a composition exceeding my capacity of understanding, I regard it as containing a kind of hidden and wonderful intelligence on the several subjects which come under it. For though I cannot comprehend it, I still suspect that there is some deeper sense underlying the words. So, despite his criticism of everybody else who claimed to understand it, he said, it's a really amazing book, and I'm sure there's a lot of great stuff in it, but I have no idea what it says. So, that was Eusebius. You know, if you want to study church history, you are going to read Eusebius, though. He was more of a historian than a theologian. Okay, so now after Eusebius comes the person who is the primary source now of what the church believes about eschatology for the next 1,000 years, until historicism, until the Catholic Church became so corrupted and fell apart. Who am I talking about? Who is the greatest thinker of Christianity, the greatest theologian, perhaps ever, but certainly in the first 1,000 years of church history?
Augustine.
That's my second guess.
And so depending on your pronunciations and all in your school of thought, some say Augustine, some say Augustine, but to clarify, you can say he's of Hippo. Okay? And he lived a long time, 354 AD to 430. Okay. And many of you are probably familiar with some of Augustine's history, how he came to conversion, how he came to faith, but his treatises and writings about the Christian faith and church are still extremely influential even to this day. But when it came to eschatology and Revelation, Augustine wrote extensively about it in numerous writings. He said Revelation is all about the past. It's all old stuff. It's all done already. Revelation is past. By that I mean the book of Revelation is past. Okay? It's very tied to the Olivet Discourse, the AD 70, so you see him kind of recapitulating here what Clement of Alexandria told us. He says that chapter 20, specifically, the chapter about the millennial kingdom, is about the church era. He references that Jesus came to defeat Satan. That's, you know, overarching history of what. Why did Jesus come? He came to defeat history. He had a victory at Calvary. He defeated and he bound Satan. He referenced Jesus' parable about how you can't just rob a strong man's house without first binding the strong man. And so he said Jesus came to rob Satan of Satan's kingdom and Satan's people. And so Jesus that whole early part of chapter 20, where it talks about the angel coming down with chains and binding Satan, is about Jesus binding Satan and stealing from Satan. The 1,000 years, Augustine wrote very specifically, is entirely symbolic. It's symbolic of the totality and unending duration of Christ's victory. Satan is bound by the gospel teaching and his work. And the way Augustine envisioned this is very similar to what we see later on in the post-millennial viewpoint, which is that the church militant is being successful. It's making a difference out there in the world. It's changing the world. The light of the gospel is going into all of the world and making the world a better place. Less pagan, less, you know, less child sacrifices happening. I mean, these are the things the gospel really does. We don't disagree with any of that in thought, okay? His views then, what Augustine taught, dominated the church for the next 1,000 years. And what do we see during that time period? Well, we think about the Dark Ages, right? But there was a lot of success for the church during the Dark Ages, despite problems, and you know, the fall of Rome led to a lot of problems throughout society everywhere. But as the church did work, it got to Ireland, right? We think about the work of St. Patrick. We think about the work amongst the Norse people, the Scandinavians, right? Who were worshiping trees. And who's the famous missionary who went out there and chopped the tree down and built a chapel out of its wood? And all of a sudden the Swedes are like, whoa, that God in the tree wasn't all that powerful, was he? You know? And you remember that story? Do some of you remember that story? It's I can't think of the name of it, but it's a true story of the missionary work that the church was doing. The monks who were going out all over, up into England and Scotland and Ireland and Spain, all over the place. The church was militantly moving out there and spreading the light of the gospel. And so, to the people, the interpretation that Augustine gave them fit with what they were seeing, okay? And it made sense to them. And so the permanence of Christianity became ingrained in the entire culture of Western society, that the kingdom of Christ was inexorably moving forward. Now, I will offer at this point just one particular thing that I just find troubling about doing this with Revelation chapter 20. You read it and you can say, okay, is the angel Christ? And he comes down and he's binding Satan, and Satan's power to hold his people is bound, and the 1,000 years is symbolic. But what then do you do with the end of that chapter where it says, until he has to be released for a short time? What do you do with that then? What does any of that mean? And he kind of just ignores that. Okay, well, you know, I don't know what to do with that. So that's what we all do with Bible verses that we don't know what to do with, right? Well, you know, tuck that one over here and maybe someday we'll figure it out. Okay, and that's one of the ones then that is like, well, I don't know what you're going to do with that verse then if you believe this particular way. So we can see a lot of church history here just cooked together when it comes to end times. I hope what you take away from some of this is that this particular struggle with understanding eschatology, the book of Revelation, and end times is not a modern issue. This is an issue that extends all the way back to the very beginnings of the church. Okay, there's been debate and ideas and some weird ideas, some craziness. How many of you have heard of the church father by the name of Origen? Okay, another very famous church father, many writings. His interpretation of Revelation, and he's just slightly before Augustine. His interpretation is entirely symbolic. The whole book is a spiritual allegory. Well, where have we heard that before? Okay, that's the idealist approach. Okay. Origen, he believed like the 7 heads of the beast are representative of the 7 different mortal sins. Okay, so everything becomes allegory. So these different viewpoints, premillennial, millennial kingdom, spiritual interpretation, preterism, they were all vying for legitimacy and a way of interpretation from early times. And there are people right now who will tell you, okay, well, the premillennial viewpoint is, and the futurist viewpoint, is all a modern day occurrence that came about because of Darby and is all part of dispensationalism. Well, that's clearly not true. Now, are there some things in the modern teachings that are clearly from the more modern interpretation? Sure. But even back in the first few centuries, the church was having guys who had weird teachings and weird predilections and got involved with weird sects and divisions within the church. And so really very little has changed when we come down to it. What my plan is for you next week is to talk to you about why, despite all that we've looked at and all the different viewpoints and how they can be tied to the scriptures and seem to fit, why I choose to be a futurist and why I believe that that's the best methodology to utilize to understand Revelation. Then after that, we're going to talk briefly about the different viewpoints of the millennium, because I think that that's really important as we go into it. And then we're finally going to get into opening up the book and just going through the book, which will probably take less time than all of this other lead up has taken us. So any thoughts or comments that anybody has? We've done a lot of church history, a lot of just building a foundation for you that I know that some of you have got pieces of, but hopefully now have come together for you. Any thoughts, questions?
Christ has already bound Satan, how can he roam about as a roaring lion? I can't see where a scholar could make that, take that position.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. We mentioned that when we were talking about that earlier a few weeks ago.
Paul is very clear that he's a present enemy.
Yeah. The prince of the power of the air remains.
Yes.
Yeah, Cindy.
So, after the apostolic age, and these new views or different views were added in, was it their thought that God just forgot something and left something out, or that in opposition to the scriptures, he really is changing along with our time? I mean, all these different views and additions into that just seem like they shouldn't have gone beyond the apostolic age.
So if you're talking about our little tangent into talking about the Montanists, etc., I would certainly agree with you. Okay, and the church really did move away from and put those aside, although to some extent they persisted all the way up to around 900 to 1,000 years. But you're talking about these different frameworks that Augustine and Clement and others laid out. I would tell you that I don't think that they saw themselves as adding to Scripture. And I think that they were making legitimate attempts at interpreting what the book of Revelation and other eschatological passages are telling us. I think that they often looked at them from the framework of the time they lived in, right? Anti-Jewish, okay? Or, hey, things are getting better, the church is better, we don't need Christ to come and rescue us, okay? But we'll talk next week about why I still choose to be a futurist and how, to me, what is the methodology we use for interpreting Scripture, right? Well, we use a methodology that tries to use the Bible to interpret the Bible, right? And how we want to take as much comprehensiveness as we can from the book and not just selectively take this passage out and then let it interpret itself minus the other 65 books of the Bible. So we'll talk about that next week. We're running out of time, so...